Brigadier Calvert, Reel 14.
I've mentioned that the most popular conversation between any two soldiers of any age and any nationality is about boots, whether they should be short or tall, what they should be made of, what the sole should be, and so on. Well, I'll come back to beards in a moment. We eventually pumped for South African-made boots. We didn't like the Indian Army boot. And on the whole, the Army boot did us proud. Packs, we started to form our own type of packs with the popular Bergen pack, as it's now become popular in the Army. As regard beards, I think Wingate realized, you see, I don't want to be too hard on the British and Indian Army at that time, but they were, to a large extent, demoralized. They thought that the Jap was invincible. There were well-meaning posters up all over India showing a most cruel and dreadful-looking Japanese burneting children and so on like that. Instead of making people want to fight the Japanese, it made them frightened. And we had to sort of build up the morale of the British, just remembering that they were tough. And I think this is why Wingate said that beards would be allowed, that the troop feeling his beard says, well, I'm a different sort of person than I was. I personally would not allow mournful beards. I remember meeting another column during operations, and they had enormous mournful beards, which were depressing. I said they were like the prophets. And I insisted they should have aggressive beards. I mentioned this in my book, Prisoners of Hope. They should have beards like the conquistadors, or they should have beards jutting out, or like the navy cut beards. I mentioned various type of things. And I found that this was an advantage. People should not wear whiskery things, should not wear long, mournful beards, but they should be properly cultivated beards, and they should look all right. Otherwise, they should be clean-shaven.
But Wingate wanted them because it was a distinguishing mark.
Yes, Wingate wanted them, not so much a distinguishing mark, because it would help morale. It would make the men feel they were tougher than they were, really. This, of course, only applied to the British troops. But he got criticized a lot by that, even though 100 years earlier, soldiers did wear beards. And a lot of what Wingate was criticized for were purely points which were changed later. When he was at the Royal Military Academy, Woolwich, he was a thinking person, and he couldn't see any reason why boots or things should be polished if you could find a bit of leather which didn't need polishing. So he'd often come on parade with his own sample of leather or his own boots, and there'd be a storm of protest. He tried out all sorts of things like that, and they were against convention. You say it's unconventional, but it wasn't unconventional for just bloody-mindedness. He was trying to improve it. And most of the, like polishing buttons, complete waste of effort, going on guard duty, standing stiff at attention instead of prowling around, like later we were taught to do in 1940. So most of what Wingate had objected to in the Royal Military Academy was changed and is changed now. So he was, you might say, in advance of his times, but he should have been easier for his life to have conformed. But he did have the sense of humour, and he may have been doing it by pulling people's legs. And people who said he hadn't got a sense of humour, I remember him saying, just before we were marching down to Imphal, and he called me over as the columns went by, and there they had their packs and their hats on one side, and they looked a bit scruffy, having marched 200 miles. And he turned to me and he said, you know, God gives man strange instruments to do his will, because these were too, not only not very high, but too rather low-grade battalions, which Wingate was going to take into the middle of Burma to fight these all-conquering Japanese.
But was Wingate scruffy in his personal habits?
I didn't ever see it. I think he used to wash extremely, man. He was always wanted water. I always remembered him washing. He was very, very conscientious and to teaching about how people should use latrines, and he taught me that more armies had been destroyed through lack of hygiene than any other way, and I hadn't realized that all that maneuvering in the 16th and 17th centuries and early 18th centuries was because, until I'd read Marshal de Saxe, it was because if you remained in one position in a huge formation of 40, 50, 100,000, hygiene deteriorated very fast, and after 5 days, dysentery would attack the army, and you'd lose up to 10% of your numbers. So one of the reasons for Marlborough's manoeuvring was to get the other side to stationary, and then disease would wipe out half the army. And this was, and also siege of Malta and other sieges, you would actually catapult in people suffering from cholera or smallpox into the besieged town to spread it. Disease was used as a weapon. And he was used to talk that, and he was very, very insistent that we should keep clean and that our feet should be good and socks should be carried and changed, and one of the most important things of all was the condition of people's feet, he insisted on. I never came across this. I think if you're a smart soldier who is good at parade ground stuff, one might have had some things, but I'd had the experience in Norway that the parade ground soldier was the worst soldier in battle, but that may have been a particular experience. And we must remember, at this time, I want to make this very point, I think I may have done before, the actual officers, keen officers and men, were appalled and disgusted the way the British Army had been defeated everywhere. We'd been defeated in Europe, we had been defeated, although we had some successes in the Middle East, mainly due to Wavell. We'd been appallingly defeated in the Far East, and the Chinese, or the Japanese had said that the Chinese were very much better soldiers than the British were. And they were so anxious to try and put things right. They were ready for a prophet who would teach them a new methods and new ideas. And Wingate's methods and ideas struck a chord. They felt that he was right, because he'd get right down to bottom. He wouldn't ask anybody to do anything which he didn't do himself. And he would carry his pack, he'd march with the column, he'd jump up on the horses, and he'd swim with the mules, he would load mules, he would, when we had gliders, he was the first person in the gliders. When the gliders were snatched, he went up in the snatched gliders. When we were practicing mortar, machine gunning, he would be the first person there. And he was absolutely tireless in his example to all ranks, and agreed he couldn't speak Gurkhali, but the Gurkhas loved him, and I think some of the Gurkha officers were jealous by the fact that the Gurkhas had such a liking for Wingate, even though he couldn't speak the language. There were tales about Wingate. I suppose any great man, I made up a saying that a man is to be pitied, for he must achieve nothing in his life if on his deathbed he has no enemies. And somebody later on told me to go and look at a particular cemetery where I saw a large ornate gravestone, so-and-so and so-and-so, loved by all. Underneath, somebody had carved, did fuck all. And I think this is about expresses it. If a man is doing a hell of a lot, he will make enemies. And you can almost judge a man by his enemies. I think that's been said before. And enemies, when get made, were the slack people, the people who didn't want to change their ideas and who were conventional. Winkett was searching for ideas, and he'd admit himself wrong when a thing went wrong. His mind was developing all the time, and this was accepted and approved by a lot of senior officers and generals. So I could mention them, including Winkett. I mean, for instance, Auchinleck, he didn't like the idea of special force, but he had no dislike of Winkett at all. But there it is. I think I'll have a pause there for a minute. Straight on?
Yes.
In the slightly wider aspects of tactics and what we might call low-down strategy, I mentioned the column march, the bivouac. Then we were to form a base. You have to form a base before you can attack anything. It's like a boxer. He must have one foot on the ground before he hits. Otherwise, his punch lacks all energy. And then we had dispersal groups. If we were attacked or overwhelmed, we would disperse into the groups, which were really platoons, which we'd come in with, into the column with, or into the bivouac with. And we had first and second rendezvous. Now, these rendezvous were very, 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 very important. You had one rendezvous which you reach within a few hours, and the rendezvous would be a point on a line. So you could hit the line like a river or a ridge or even a path, and then you could go up and down it till you found the point. You wouldn't sit on it, but you'd go into the jungle nearby, and so that anybody lost could go back to the first rendezvous and be picked up from there. And then you had a second rendezvous, which is much further back, where if the whole column was dispersed, you could go to it and reform. I don't know where he got this from. It's probably from other forces who'd fought like us, maybe in the North American wars and North American Indian wars. But these worked. He also tried out attack in column and attack line abreast. These weren't so successful, and certainly the line abreast thing was a failure. I remember him teaching the 13th Kings this and trying them out on a very hot day, and it must have been maddening for the Kings to practice this. But his method of getting through the jungle to the target were right. Then you had to, as I saw it, you had to reform and fight as a regular company or battalion. So on the second Wingate operation, I taught my brigade. I had longer time to teach them than any other brigade, apart from 111 Brigade, which were General Intayn's brigade. But he wouldn't follow Wingate's teaching. So what I would do, I would teach my units to advance in column, to move in column, and then to reform as a battalion and to reform as a brigade. And I practiced this because this meant a change of communications and so on. And you had possibly to brigade your 3-inch mortars, and you had to certainly get your Vickers machine guns under one command so they were in proper position. And I would also, I thought that the only way we could take a major objective was by reforming into these well-known units. And this was so, because in an attack, you've got to maintain the momentum. You can do attack, you can overrun, but unless you've got reinforcements to go through that, and then another lot to go through that, and so on, and then you want to reform a reserve so that you can affect the battle, because a commander can't affect the battle unless he's got a reserve, you don't overcome any objective or force which is worthwhile. And so I departed from Wingate's teaching there, and my later brigade, 77th Brigade, where in certainly one battle I had 9 or 10 battalions under command. We fought in this way, and we defeated some very strong and powerful opposition. And so the second Wingate operation was totally different to the first. I'll just go back one more, that we practice RAF air supply, and I haven't mentioned, I mentioned, but I didn't expand on Air Marshal the Earl of Bandon. When Wingate was obtaining all the details of his brigade, he had to go to GHQ Delhi, which is an enormous place. And somehow the Earl of Bandon, who was an Air Commodore then, or he might have been Air Vice Marshal, he allowed us to use one of his offices from which we could operate. He also lent us his chief clerk, who was an absolute wizard at knowing how to draft letters and how and whom to approach. And so very often he would reprimand Wingate, said, "You're going about this quite the wrong way. The way to achieve this is by a letter to the chief, from chief clerk to chief clerk, to prepare the way, then to somebody else, then have a come in for a cup of tea and talk about the thing over, long before you present your demands." And it was this sort of lobbying method which the Earl of Bandon taught Wingate, because it really was to try and obtain what he wanted through that huge mountain of bureaucracy was very difficult. And the Earl of Bandon helped us a hell of a lot, besides getting us the RAF officers and detachments concerned. He should take a lot of credit for that. Bernard Ferguson was in Ops, and he volunteered to come in with us. I think he was being sent by Wavell. He was a great friend of Wavell, come the same regiment and so on, and I think that Wavell persuaded him to come in with us, and he was of great value in commanding column and also in being able to record our operation as he did in his books. Unfortunately, he didn't have a lot of fighting either in the first Wingate operation or the second. So these are these very well-written books. But to a lot of readers, especially military readers, he doesn't give the impression of any achievement apart from overcoming great hardships. And it doesn't give the impression, what a soldier wants is, Who were the enemy? Did he defeat them? How many corpses were there? How many guns were captured? And what was the result? And did they advance in territory? Well, it's unfortunate that Bernard Ferguson's column was chosen. Well, it did carry out one demolition and then came out very well. But in the second operation, his brigade marched in, was tired out by this very, very long march, which I would have never asked my brigade to do, and then was rather caught hopping and was defeated in detail by the Japanese around Kathar, K-A-T-H-A. And then he was withdrawn. I received two of his battalions, and I made them fight as they'd been taught, as battalions, and they did very well indeed. But it's easy to learn from other people's mistakes. And I think that Bernard Ferguson was useful in the fact that he could write to Wavell direct and to try and give the feel, not being disloyal in any way, but give the feel, the nuance, of the whole force and operations. Now I can say that, I'll just have to finish there, I think, at this time, that before I even get on to the operation, to the first Wingate operation, not has been written about it. But not much has been written about this training and the personalities. In his dispatches to Amory, they discussed, as much as you can discuss by signal, as to whether it had been the right thing of introducing Wingate into India and Burma, and whether they wouldn't have done better to introduce him into Italy, where he might have roused the generals and troops there to get a move on with the war after the first landings in Italy. What it needed was a much more punch, and they discussed this and they decided that it probably wouldn't have worked, but it is a thought that Wingate could have possibly have raised the Italian guerrillas better and have got to move on with the war instead of letting Lys and others bring it almost to a halt whilst they did planned attacks and planned this, that and the other. He'd probably managed to have kept the front fluid. On the other hand, he'd have probably annoyed everybody. But they had no question. There might have been psychological, the full good general is, psychological masters. But they had no hesitation in realizing that Wingate would stir things up. That was what he was there for. And he did so. I give an example. I attended a meeting. And I went in as his sort of ADC. And there were all the heads of department, generals, and Auchinleck was there. Wavell had taken over. And Wavell had gone to Viceroy. This must have been before the second operation. And there was about a dozen high-ranking officers there. And Wingate proposed his things and wanted this and wanted that. And then everybody, with one accord, started to make excuses why it was not possible. This was not possible, that was not possible. So on. And Wingate came in with a few historical examples which proved that he was right. And there again, Auchinleck was trying to be fair, and then Wingate's alarm clock went off. And he said, "I know it's no use talking to you, gentlemen. The fact is, you know, none of you know anything about war." And he put on his topi. He had his Macintosh over his uniform. And he saluted and walked out. I was called back. And he said, Auchinleck said, for God's sake, keep him here. I want to have another word with him privately. And then I took him back to see Auchinleck. Well, that was not a good way of doing things. But he did it when he did make a thing of that nature. He had done it deliberately. He felt that the argument had gone on so far that he had to force a break. You can see how politicians sometimes do this. He had worked it out. Bernard Ferguson, myself, and others tried to dissuade him from doing some of these things. But he put his own whole career on the line and came out with these words to impress people. And I know one of the generals there, I was speaking to him after the war in the Knights Services Club, and he said one thing about Wingate: he had guts. He had both physical and moral guts, much more than any of us had. And that is a pretty good compliment to Wingate.
This alarm clock, why didn't he use a wristwatch?
God knows. I think it was for effect. He didn't always use the alarm clock, but he used to at times do it. It was an exaggeration to say he walked about with an alarm clock all the time. He didn't, but he would. This was part of his sort of theatre. But I must admit, I ought to say this, is that people say, "Do you like Wingate?" and so on. All I can say, he was very, very good for me. And I respond, so do a lot of people, to a hard taskmaster. I like people who speak out and tell me where I was wrong, give me a rocket or this, that and the other, rather than somebody who says, "Yes, yes, quite, quite," and then puts a bad report in about me. He wasn't always a happy man to have around. In fact, I felt he was like a conscience. He felt, now what ought I to be doing? If Wingate came along, now what am I doing wrong? What ought I to be doing? So you were trying to improve what you do. And he judged by how you could fight and your preparations for fight. Now he liked his drink. He liked whiskey. Once or twice only, I drunk with him, or he's drunk with other people, and he has got quite sozzled. Now, he knew this was a weakness, and he faced it, and he said, "I am a man who's trying to do this, and therefore I mustn't get drunk." And so he had this, he was a Plymouth Brethren sort of stock, he was low church, and he... very similar to General Dobby, whom I knew very well, Royal Engineers, who was in Malta, Dobbie. And of other